Thank you for having me.
And let's just start with a little bit of background, a little bit about who you are and how you came to, how you found fiction or creative writing. Or another way to put it is, oftentimes I ask poets, how did you find poetry? And they say, poetry found me. So maybe fiction found you. How did you get interested in, when did you know you were going to be a writer? Give us a little background.
Sure. As a child, I was an avid reader. And I don't know, for no apparent reason, I thought, oh, I want to be a fashion designer. But, you know, it just looked sort of like a pie in the sky kind of thing. Uh-huh. And then what happened was, it was in elementary school. The whole school had to, like, write a story, uh-huh, which really was probably like a paragraph or like a page, you know. And what happened was, the principal came to my classroom and she said I had the best story. And she gave me a candy bar.
Aww. I hope it was a $100,000 candy bar. Was it 100,000 grand or whatever that's called?
No, you know, I think it's one of those candy bars that, like, you know, schools sell.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The kind that's, you know, wrapped in paper and then it's got foil,
yeah,
around it. And,
exactly.
And it's flat.
Exactly.
Yeah, wow. And you still remember that. Do you remember what the story was about?
I don't. I remember I used the word grotesque in it.
Oh, my God.
But that's all I remember.
That's funny.
When I was young, I would always look up words I didn't know.
Uh-huh. And that was, how old were you when that happened?
I would say I was probably like 10.
Wow. And it stuck,
yeah,
with you.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how old you are, and I'm not going to ask, but I'm old. I'm 57 years old, and when I was in school, we used to have these pieces of paper where there would be a place to draw and then lines so you can write a story and draw a picture. I remember one of the stories that I wrote, which got no praise at all, by the way, it was called Hamburger versus Hot Dog, and it was about this giant hot dog fighting in New York City, destroying buildings, and they were saved by Super Taco. He came in and he split them up, and I think of it now, and I go, wow, that's really kind of reflecting my culture as a Chicano, you know? I mean, yeah, the taco
know,
is what
like
mediates
that.
My American. But that's fantastic. And so was it at that point that you said, I'm just going to write stories, and you start writing and writing? Or did you still want to be a fashion designer?
No. I mean, you know what happened is I spent a lot of time saying I wanted to be a writer, but
uh-huh,
I didn't write.
Uh-huh.
And when I got to high school, you know, like, I wrote terrible poems. I think a lot of people, and I feel sorry for poets, like,
right,
I think a lot of people start writing poetry because they just think it's easy.
Right.
And, you know, I wrote some terrible poems, and I think I did that in college, too. And then in college, I did take some fiction workshops, and then right after college, I went to Emerson and I got my MFA. But I felt like I was really sort of like a beginner,
uh-huh,
in terms of learning how to write. So I feel like my MFA was like super helpful because I feel like it taught me the basics of writing, which I didn't have yet. And then I got a PhD in English and creative writing. And there I kept developing my writing, and then I graduated, and, you know, I worked, and, you know, I spent a lot of time not writing, where I would sit down to write, and I would, like, have a lot of fear, and so I would just sort of, like, run away, and so basically, the short story collection that I published last year, Love War Stories, you know, I started it, the first story I started was Love War Stories, and I started that story like in 1996.
Wow.
And yeah, and so, you know, I did a lot of rookie mistakes. I sent out the collection when it wasn't ready,
right,
and I sent
right,
out
yeah,
stories when they weren't ready. So then I just sort of like dealt with a lot of rejection, which I think I could have avoided, and that could have helped my self-esteem a little bit more. But basically, I just kind of gave up on the collection because I was like, okay, it's just not going to get published, and I'm going to move on. I'm going to pick myself up, and I'm going to move on, and I'm going to work on a novel. And so I was working on a novel, and then I saw that the Feminist Press had the Louise Merriweather First Book Prize,
mm-hmm,
for a woman or non-binary writer of color. So I said, well, this collection is just sitting here. I'll just send it.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah, yeah, which is what I did. And so Then it ended up being a finalist. As far as I know, there were like five finalists, and it didn't win, but they wanted to publish it anyway, and here we are. Wow. So.
And Feminist Press is a fantastic press. We had Anna Castillo on the show to talk about her book with Feminist Press, and it's a fantastic book. I'm sure you know it.
Yeah, I got to read with her this summer, and I was
oh my god, that's awesome!
I can't believe I get to read with Anna Castillo.
Yeah, you know, someday though, someone's gonna say, "Oh my god, I got to read with Ivelisse Rodriguez." You know that, right?
But I'm like, you know, I read Anna Castillo in college, and it's so like, it's those things that you can't even believe are like come true. Like, it's just so inconceivable to you that this could possibly happen one day, you know. And it was just amazing. She was amazing. So
yeah, I totally get it. I saw her last in Spain 2 years ago, where she was the keynote speaker to the Latino Literature Conference, and she was amazing as always. You know, you gave us your bio, your writer's bio in a nutshell, but there's a transition that you made that I just don't accept, and that is, you says you were writing some stories in as an undergraduate, and you took a thing, and then you says, and then I went to Emerson College. But that's, I just want people to know that you don't just go to Emerson College and get an MFA. You have to apply, and you're competing with hundreds of other people who want to get into Emerson College or MFA. So you must have been pretty good back then, even as an undergraduate writer. Are there any of the stories that you wrote then that are now in your wonderful collection of stories, Love and Love War stories?
Oh, all of them. So my Emerson thesis was about like maybe 80 pages.
Uh-huh.
So all the stories that were in that thesis or in the collection, but obviously, like, radically revised.
Right, right.
Yeah, so, well, the thing is, you know, I kept, you know, I actually spoke at Emerson recently, and, you know, for all this time, I had been like, how did I get into Emerson, you know? And I was like, I think that even though I don't think I was structurally sound in terms of writing, I think I had, like, a distinct voice.
Right.
And so I'm assuming maybe that's why I got in, you know?
Well, no, you got in because you're a good writer. I mean, I've been teaching in the MFA program here at the University of Texas, El Paso for, I don't know, geez, my gosh, that makes me sound so old, 20 years now. And one thing that the main criteria for acceptance, we don't really look at grade point average. We don't look at, that's the writing sample. We want good writers that can go out and publish. So obviously they believed in you even then.
Right. Which is what I think. And they were so supportive. And, you know, a lot of people have bad experiences in MFA programs.
Yeah,
but
I was going to ask you about that.
I had a really good experience because, like I said, they were like super supportive and, you know, just encouraging. And I'll never forget, like, you know, just their grace and, you know, their support for my work.
Yeah, people, especially people of color, often have, you know, horrible stories about going to universities and the MFA experience, and so that's really good. I'm happy to hear they were so supportive. Love War Stories is it's a beautiful collection of stories. A friend of ours, a mutual friend of ours, recommended it to me as I was searching for a book. I have a list of books I'm going to teach next semester in a graduate seminar, and I was looking for another one, and she suggested yours, and so I bought it and read it, and I think it's just fantastic. Congratulations. It's a beautiful collection.
Thank you so much.
Are you happy with it? Are you happy with the experience?
Oh, I totally am. Like, I did get a little paranoid, like, when I had to submit my last, like, submission to my editor.
Like they were going to change their mind?
No, but I was like, there's still something wrong with, like, I don't know. Like, I felt like there were still a couple things wrong. So it's like, I revised, I think, like, three stories, you know, like, in depth, like, in 1 week and, like, right before submission. And somebody was like, no, you know, they usually don't want such radical revisions at the so late in the game. But I was like, oh, it'll make me feel better. then my editor accepted them. So that worked out well. You know, just because I had spent so much time trying to publish this book and I had been met with so much rejection, but I thought, you know, at the beginning of this whole process, I was like, you know, I'll just be happy that it got published and what have you. And then, like, all these, like, miraculous things started to happen. Like, it started to make these lists for, like, books to read in 2018. And, you know, it made a list for Cosmopolitan.com. And it was just kind of crazy. And it's also so surreal. But I'm like, I'm sure I'm the only person that's seeing this on the list. You know? Like,
right,
this is crazy. So, and then... and then I was hoping that it'd get nominated for an award, and it didn't during, like, the fall award season, and I was kind of glum about that. And then one day I get this call, and it's a finalist for the Penn Faulkner, and I was like, oh my God.
And that's huge. Just to be a finalist in that would make any writer happy.
Right. That's why I'm like, you know, I think a lot of people are emphasizing on winning, and I'm sort of like, to be a finalist? I'm like, that's winning to me. Like, you know, I'm like, it's incredible.
You know, you posted this this article on your Facebook page, your book might not sell and you have to live with that. And the subtitles, I didn't write my book for the money, but I wasn't really prepared for it to go nowhere. And that's something that happens to a lot of writers. You know, they'll publish a book and they're all excited. And but then they check their Amazon ratings, or they, you know, they look at their book their book sales, and they're disappointed. How's your book doing, and are you happy with the number of sales?
No, I don't think it's selling that well at all, even with the Penn Faulkner nomination. And at first I was so like freaked out by that, but my publicist kept saying, well, what's more important, like book sales or publicity? And, like she was talking, you know, just about the idea that, you know, obviously it's getting a lot of press, blah, blah, blah. And then actually I was at the Texas Book Festival and I was talking to Angie Cruz, and she was talking about this idea of like your book being visible. And I thought that was really interesting. I was like, that's probably just another way to like, really sort of capture that idea of success, because so many people would be like, oh, congratulations on your book success. But I was so focused on like the numbers that I was like, whoa. But then I was like, well, I mean, if you were reading about book last year, you probably heard of it. And I'm like, and that's a big deal, you know?
Right.
So, you know, I mean, it's still a little hard to let go of the sales thing, but I think I'm, like, much better about it than I was before. So.
Oh, yeah. It took me 7 books to let go of it, and I still don't think I'm very successful. I just came out with a book a month ago. It's called Kafka in a Skirt, Stories from the Wall. And I thought, oh, man, this is going to, you know, get a lot of attention. And it got, you know, some publicity, like you said. I like that distinction, but I don't think anybody's buying it, and I have to be okay with that.
I know. It's a tough pill to swallow, and, like, you know, I was talking to another writer, and she told me not to, like, tell, like, such negative things to, like, emerging writers, but, you know, I'm teaching grad students this semester, and I was totally, like, oh, you could do all these things, but nothing can happen. I'm like, I've never seen an industry like this.
Yeah,
where it's like
weird.
You can check off all the boxes, but it doesn't mean you're going to get the result that like you worked for. Like, it's insane. I mean, it's a tough pill to swallow. This is such a weird industry, and
yeah, it is really a tough industry. But you know what? You, your book is beautiful, and you have. I didn't get the hard copy of the book because we just had a baby, and the only time I really can read is when the lights are out and the baby's sleepy. So I bought it on the Kindle and just love the stories. But you got blurbs from amazing writers. You got one from Juno Diaz, Patricia Engel, Christina Garcia. It says Juno says a tough, smart, dazzling debut by a tough, smart, dazzling writer. Evelise Rodriguez is a revelation. That's really, as the impression of Nick Cage on SNL goes, that's high praise. But but Patricia Engel, who's also been on the show, and so has Juno, it says, wise, ferocious, and beautifully executed, these tales trace the tangled roots of trauma and desire. Rodriguez is a writer to watch. And I'm wondering, when I read your book, I kind of feel there is some sort of, and I don't want to use the wrong word here, but some sort of not similar, but some sort of there's a little bit of Juno Diaz in it, and I'm wondering if that Juno, if the aspect of Juno Diaz inside your, you know, that's in some of the stories and some of the characters and some of the situations, is that a conscious thing, or is that just something you think because you have similar experience? Although he writes about New York and you write often about Holyoke, is there some sort of dialogue with Juno Diaz in your work?
I think that's a great question. I think the story that most people would compare to Juno's work would be Summer of Nene. Mm-hmm. And I can obviously see why the similarities. I do love Drown. I think it's a great story. That story's a little weird. It sort of like came out like in two sittings.
Uh-huh.
And
wow.
I'm fully formed. I'm like, okay, this is never going to happen again. I think, what I've always said about Juno is this. It's sort of like Perry Thomas was the first Puerto Rican writer I read. And, you know, he really, you know, talked about, like, what it's like to grow up being Puerto Rican, like, in, you know, a particular neighborhood, et cetera. And I feel like Juno is, like, sort of the heir of, like, Perry Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
And, but Juno has an MFA. So then there's this very, like, I don't want to say great writing, because I think Donny's New Streets is great writing too, but I don't know. Juno's levels, you know, Juno's writing is on a different level. Like, it's literary and it's beautiful, but it also, like, captures what it's like to be, for him, what captures, you know, captures what it's like to be Dominican, like, in a city and thriving, et cetera. And so, for me, that's totally, like, what I want to capture too, mm-hmm. what it's like to create like literary fiction, but then also talk about where I'm coming from, et cetera.
Right.
So I think that those would be like the similar thread.
Yeah, but also, and no disrespect to Juno Diaz, but also you kind of deepen the narrative in the sense that it is about women. And it is
right.
about sometimes women who wait, you know, who are waiting for mm-hmm. men, like the first story, which is just really a beautiful, heartbreaking story. I mean, you are adding an element to that narrative, I guess. No, that's probably a bad word. And I don't want to choose the right words, but yours has a lot more depth because it goes deeper into human experience.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a safe thing to say? You don't want to comment on that. That's okay. Basically, what I'm saying is, this isn't
a compliment.
I mean, let's talk about, for example, your story about Holyoke, Massachusetts. You grew up there, and I didn't know this before I read your collection, that Holyoke has more Puerto Ricans than any other city outside of Puerto Rico. And however, most Puerto Rican narratives are taking place in New York. And I think, are you the first one to write about Holyoke?
Yes.
I thought so.
It's the highest concentration of Puerto Ricans. That's what it is.
Also, per capita, we're talking.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that was the thing, you know, obviously, like I said, I have a PhD, and the PhD is in English and creative writing, and so one of my areas is Latinx literature, and then, of course, I love Puerto Rican literature from the continental U.S., and so all the Puerto Rican literature that I've read from the continental U.S. focused on a New Yorkian experience, and so for me, doing research and having grown up in Western Massachusetts, where it's not only Holyoke, but it's some of the surrounding cities like Springfield and Chicopee, and then even going, you know, crossing the state line to Connecticut and looking at Hartford. So all these Puerto Ricans there, you know,
right.
And I had never read a story about Puerto Ricans in this particular enclave. And the thing is that there are other enclaves of Puerto Ricans across the U.S., like in Cleveland, like in Hawaii, and now, you know, in Orlando, et cetera, and they never get written about. And for us, at least in Holyoke, you know, we have about a 60 to 70-year history in the area. And so I thought it was important to map out these other enclaves and give them a voice, too, and show the world that we exist also, that Puerto Ricans aren't just in New York or in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, no, I think it's an important part of the Latinx literature, because, you know, I can't help but think when I was reading the story where we have a little history of mm-hmm. Holyoke, and then we go to Veronica's story, and then we go back to history, and then go back to Veronica's story. I really love that back and forth, because I think that in many ways expresses you as a writer, that you care about the community, you care about these social, political, historical issues, but you also care about character, and you care about desire, and you care about those things that we love when it comes to fiction. And you also kind of do that in the story about Julia de Burgos, but I'll get to that in a little bit. But anyway, what I wanted to say or ask have you ever thought about, when I was reading the story, I wanted more Holyoke. I wanted to know that community, because you really painted, you know, very vividly, and I'd never been there before, and I felt like I finally got a chance to see it. I've heard it before. Mm-hmm. I think there's a college there. A friend of mine used to teach it. I think, didn't Patrick Rosal used to teach in Holyoke?
It's Mount Holyoke. It's in like the next town over. It's in South Hadley.
Oh, okay.
It's just like different worlds.
Yeah, okay. But I wanted to see it, and I thought, I couldn't help but think, and this is going to sound weird, but I couldn't help but think of Winesburg, Ohio. And I thought, this could be an entire book called Holyoke, Massachusetts. Have you ever thought about writing Holyoke stories almost just as a way to, you know, emphasize the community?
I did, actually. I had some other stories that I had thought about. They never got off the ground, but, they were just sort of like in my writing journal. Like,
right.
There was one about a boy and his father, but they were working, like, in the tobacco fields, which is, like, something we did, like, well, I only did it once over the summer, but it was, like, grueling work. And, of course, nobody thinks about tobacco fields in, like, Massachusetts, and there was, you know, there would be like the tobacco bus. It would pick people up at like 5 a.m., like in the morning. And then there was also like the sense that it was sort of like gross, vulgar work. Like people would be made fun of to like work there. But as a kid, it was sort of like, oh, this is an easy way to get a job, you know? But it was utterly exhausting, you know?
Wow. And then you have that story called The Simple Truth, and it does the same thing as Holyoke, as the Holyoke story, in the sense that, you know, the previous story goes from Veronica to Holyoke history, but this one goes from Julia de Burgos, one of the greatest Puerto Rican poets, and then to the narrator whose father introduced her to Julio de Burgos. Mm-hmm. And so it has a history, and it has that. But what's really interesting, I posted something about this on Facebook. You write, "Who will know her if you do not go into your classrooms each semester and teach the poetry of Julio de Burgos?" And I wanted to ask you a little bit about her, and thank you for reminding me of her. I've seen her name, and I'm sure I've read her poems and anthologies, but I never really stopped to consider her poetry until this book, and I started looking up and reading. But let me close with a quote. We've been talking to Evelise Rodriguez. Her new collection of stories, Love War Stories, is a beautiful book of stories. But I want to end with a quote. This is from one of the stories. "The thing about Holyoke girls is that they don't realize how important other girls are to them. Their hearts pound for each other when they walk into parties. The way the night unfolds has nothing to do with rapping to a new guy, but if they fight with another girl." That's a beautiful quote.
Thank you.
Evelisa, thank you so much for joining us on Words on a Wire, and I wish you the best of luck with this book. And when you're done with The Last Salsa Singer, please, please be on the show again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. This was a great conversation.